This is a recording from the Virginia Festival of the Book, sponsored by the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. On Saturday, March 20th, 2010, three authors with books on the nation's highest court convened in city council chambers for a discussion of their biographies of Supreme Court justices. The moderator is Barbara Perry, director of the Center for Civic Renewal at Sweetbriar College, and an author in her own right.
I'm the author of The Supremes, an introduction to the U.S. Supreme Court justices, and that book is here for you to see this morning. I'm also here, of course, with my colleagues. I'll introduce in a moment. But I first wanted to welcome you on behalf of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. I'm sure many of you know Bob O'Neill and Josh Wheeler, who have led that organization now for 20 years. They're celebrating the 20th anniversary of the center. And it is very proud to list among its many accomplishments that it has participated in each of the 16 Virginia festivals of the book. Beginning this spring, the Thomas Jefferson Center will be holding a number of events throughout the year to celebrate its 20 years of protecting First Amendment rights. For those of you who would like to receive notice of these events, we will have a sign-up sheet available for you after the program, and we'll put that down here by the books. Here it is. Feel free to sign up to get that information from the Thomas Jefferson Center. We obviously also want to thank the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. They make this wonderful festival possible for all of these 16 years. It would not be spring in Charlottesville without the book festival. That's how we know spring has finally arrived. That and the daffodils, thank goodness. We also ask at the end of today's program if you will fill out an evaluation. The foundation asks that you do that. That helps them to have information, obviously, about the programs. It also helps to keep the festival free and open to the public. We'd also like to thank M. Rivac and Company for providing our books today. And again, they'll be here for you. I'm told that we don't have another panel coming in after us, so you're welcome to stay and chat with our authors today. Obviously, if you'd like to purchase a book, they'd be happy to sign them and inscribe them for you. Our program today is called Covering the Court. And some of you might have been here last year for last year's panel that was also organized by the Thomas Jefferson Center, and it too was called Covering the Court. So I'm calling this Covering the Court, the sequel. Last year's Covering the Court was from the perspective of journalists. So it had current journalists who cover the court and how they do so from a journalistic perspective. Covering the Court, the sequel, is about how biographers cover the court. So each and every person here today has written at least one biography of a Supreme Court justice. And I'm now going to introduce our panelists in the order in which they speak. And I will start with Mimi Clark Grundlin to my left. I'm happy to say that I've known all of these members of our panel for many, many years. It's my honor to know all of them. And in Mimi's case, we met almost exactly, I believe it was 15 years ago, at the Supreme Court at a wonderful luncheon presided over by then Chief Justice William Rehnquist. And at that luncheon, I received the most wonderful award I've ever been bestowed. And it was the Tom C. Clark Award. It's given every year to the Outstanding Judicial Fellow at the Supreme Court. And I was lucky enough to spend an entire year at the court and get to know Mimi and her family. Unfortunately, I never met her father, but I feel like I know him through knowing his family. His granddaughters and great-grandchildren are here today, and we welcome them. Mimi holds a master's degree from George Mason University. She was a reference librarian for 22 years at Northern Virginia Community College, and the name of her book, which truly was a labor of love, Supreme Court Justice Tom C. Clark, A Life of Service. If you want to know more about the book, you can go to its own website, www.tomclark.com. To my right is Tinsley Yarborough. Tinsley and I have known each other also for many years. I can't remember exactly how many, and I probably don't want to mention how many, but we know each other through our mutual mentor, Henry Abraham. Professor Abraham is in the audience today, is the foremost constitutional law scholar in the country, and we're pleased to have him. Tinsley is the author of Harry Blackmun, The Outsider Justice. That book is available to you today. Tinsley is the professor emeritus of political science at East Carolina University. His book subjects also include, in addition to Justice Harry Blackmun, a biography of David Souter, which is not on sale today, but which you can get, I'm sure, from Oxford University Press, and I'm sure from Amazon as well. He has also written biographies of Justice John Marshall Harlan I, Justice John Marshall Harlan II, Hugo Black. He's written a book on the Rehnquist Court itself. He's also written an award-winning biography on Alabama's Judge Frank Johnson, which won the ABA's Silver Gavel Award, which is like the Academy Award given by the ABA each year. So it is not an exaggeration to say that Tinsley is the foremost judicial biographer, I was going to say of his generation, but I think it's of any generation, certainly of the 20th and now the 21st century. So we're delighted to have him with us today. And to Tinsley's right is Amy Campbell. And Amy and I go back a long ways as well because she was my student at Sweetbriar College, a star student then, and I am just so proud of her and all that she has accomplished. She is here today to substitute for John Jeffries, who was listed on the original program. He was called away to a family function in California, and very nicely, Amy, who lives now in Northern Virginia, agreed to take his place, and we're very lucky that she's here. She is the author of a book called Raising the Bar, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the ACLU Women's Rights Project. If you can imagine, Amy, as a graduate student, to show you how good she was able to gain access to Justice Ginsburg. Justice Ginsburg gave her interviews at the court, made all of her pre-court papers available to Amy, and then went through the manuscript with her to add material or, in some cases, perhaps subtract material. But she just had unprecedented access to Justice Ginsburg. Amy, in addition to holding her degree from Sweetbriar, also has a master's from the University of Virginia in government. She has published in the University of Texas Law Review, in the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and the Washington Post. She serves now as the creative director of Pink Collar, Inc., which is a creative consulting group that she co-founded in 2008. So please welcome all of our panelists here today. So I'm going to turn first to Mimi Grundlin and ask her to talk about the book about her father. I do have a gavel, so I'm going to pretend I'm the Chief Justice today. And the Chief Justice, when there is oral argument, he looks out over the crowd. There would be 300 people or so gathered in the courtroom, and there would be one person about where this lady is here who would be arguing the case, and there would be a podium. There's a white light and a red light on that podium. When the person who's arguing has 2 minutes left, the Chief Justice turns on the white light to indicate 2 minutes left. Well, I don't have a light to turn on, but I have a white piece of paper that says 2 minutes. So each panelist is going to take about 8 to 10 minutes. When the two-minute time comes up, I will hand that along to you. And I don't have a red light, but I have a pink slip and a please stop note. So given that my background is very Germanic, we'll try to stick to the time frame because we want to leave plenty of time for those of you in the audience to ask questions of our wonderful panelists. So thank you so much again for being here, and Mimi, I will turn things over to you.
Thank you so much, Barbara, and thank everyone for being here today. I do want to say that our family is very proud of Barbara and very happy that she was a Tom Clark Fellow and wears his name. She is certainly a wonderful example of what he would admire in a lawyer and a professional. My qualifications and background are quite different from my distinguished colleagues, since I'm the daughter of my subject. My father, Tom Clark, was Attorney General of the United States from 1945 to 49, and then on the Supreme Court from 1949 to 1967. Now, I'm a little embarrassed to tell you that I spent about 30 years writing and researching this book. I think Tinsley Yarbrough wrote about a dozen or so books during that time period. I was fairly young when I started. And I had three of our 5 daughters at home still. I had just started working full-time as a reference librarian at Northern Virginia Community College, and had a husband who required some attention, so I didn't plunge into the biography immediately. I did start interviewing people, fortunately, since many of those are now deceased. 2 of my father's sisters were still living, a sister-in-law, of course my mother, and 3 of the justices who served on the court with him, Justices William Brennan, Potter Stewart, and Byron White. And then I did enroll in an English master's in English degree program at George Mason University, and my master's thesis was on the first 37 years of my father's life. Those were the years before he joined the federal government. That was 1984. That master's thesis actually is the basis for the first section of the book. But Tom Clark was born in Dallas, Texas in 1899. His parents were from Mississippi. They had moved to Dallas for a greater opportunity. Daddy was the 7th of 10 children, 8 of whom survived adulthood. He was very much a Texan. He went to VMI for 1 year, but family circumstances made him leave after 1 year, went to the University of Texas. And by 1937, he was in a very profitable, thriving law firm after some years of struggle, and had the opportunity to come to Washington, he thought, as an assistant attorney general in the Department of Justice. Now, when he arrived, he discovered that he was not an assistant attorney general. He was a special assistant. They were not very special. There were about 100 of them. And he was put, instead of the claims division, which he had thought he was in, going to head, he was in the War Risk Litigation Office, known as the graveyard of the Department of Justice. Fortunately, he dug his way out of the graveyard quickly and was in a position in the antitrust division under a very dynamic Assistant Attorney General Thurman Arnold. And Arnold sent him to California in 1940 to head up the West Coast offices of the antitrust division. By the way, we were always returning to Texas. No more than 2 years would we be in Washington. Well, we moved to California. Pearl Harbor occurred because the Department of Justice had offices along the West Coast already established. My father was appointed coordinator between the Army and the Department of Justice. He was not a policymaker. However, he was involved in the Japanese internment. And there is a chapter in the book called His Greatest Mistake. He was assigned the responsibility of identifying internment camps for the Japanese. And he at that time felt that military necessity required that the Japanese be interned. He was the first public official to apologize and express his regret over his involvement in that policy. But he was only involved 3 months. He came back. He became an assistant attorney general. He was involved as assistant attorney general over the lands division, or not the lands, the criminal division, in war fraud cases. And through that, he met Senator Harry Truman. Truman was the chairman of a committee investigating and prosecuting war frauds cases. And they hit it off. They were very similar. In 1945, April, President Roosevelt died. Vice President Truman became president, and he appointed Tom Clark Attorney General. And my father was the first Attorney General to have worked his way up through the through the Department of Justice. It was a hot time to be Attorney General. I think it always is, but it was the early Cold War, beginning of the McCarthy era. The conservatives were accusing Truman and his Attorney General of being soft on communism. The liberals were saying that the policies were a threat to individual liberty. There was policy or Attorney General's list of subversive organizations that was very controversial. And again, you see the balance between, or the attempt to balance national security through with individual liberty. There was also a great push toward civil rights. I think everyone knows that Truman integrated the armed forces. However, they also were involved in civil rights legislation, which did not pass, but I think had it, we would have seen civil rights improvement and a civil rights movement 10 to 15 years earlier than we did. In 1948, my father was very active in the campaign to reelect Harry Truman. He kept saying, Truman will win. And Mother and I kept saying, he is a hopeless optimist. That's not going to happen. Well, Truman won. A lot of people had deserted him. But my father had remained loyal. And consequently, at that point, my father had been Attorney General 4 years. We were again going back to Texas, and then Associate Justice Frank Murphy died suddenly of a heart attack. I believe he was 56, 58 years old. He was young. And Tom Clark was appointed to the court. And that was the last time we were planning to go back to Texas. We realized this was going to be permanent. My father really didn't like the court at first. He was a very gregarious person. He was a man of action, and suddenly he goes from this highly active, stressful position, Attorney General, to a very quiet, scholarly, rather isolated position on the Supreme Court. He learned to love it, but it took, I would say, 3 to 5 years, and I think that is not unusual. It is, it's a different world on the court. He was considered a conservative. He was not a conservative. He was not a liberal on the court. He was in no way motivated by ideology. He judged each case individually, and his opinion was made based on the individual facts of that case. But he was, in his particularly the early years, when they were many cases about loyalty oaths and communism, he usually came down on the side of national security, the government, or law enforcement. He was always a progressive on civil rights, despite the fact his parents were from Mississippi. His grandfather was killed in battle, fighting on the side of the Confederacy. And his parents were not fond of Abraham Lincoln. My grandmother, when given the opportunity, would decline the offer to go to the Lincoln Memorial. She preferred not to. I'd just like to read one thing that gives you, I hope, a description or an idea of his philosophy on the court. And this was written at the time of Brown v. Board, which, of course, was a landmark decision on segregation, and he was one of the unanimous, it was a unanimous court that handed down the opinion on that legislation. And these are his words. I'd always thought that the Constitution was not written in a vacuum, and we ought not to put straitjackets around the amendments. I rather think that there was a definite purpose on the part of the founders, and especially, particularly Madison and those that wrote the Bill of Rights, to couch them in ambiguous words so that later generations might be able to interpret them to the necessities of their times, not to be bound in this straitjacket that you would be in if they specified with such specificity that you couldn't escape it. They wanted to give you an escape hatch that you could go through. You see, we don't have any army to enforce our opinions, and we don't have any money to buy ads to run favorable ads in newspapers. The only way we have is logic and the force and common sense of the opinion. And I think that tells a lot about his philosophy as a justice. I'd just like to add quickly, he was also a delightful person. He was fun as a daughter, and I know my daughters will agree with this. He was a great dad, a great grandfather, and just a very delightful person, and I try to convey that. The book is really both biography, it's a combination biography and memoir, and I hope that you will have a chance to know Tom Clark and enjoy not only his contributions, but a very dedicated and delightful public servant.
Great. Mimi, thank you so much. I didn't even have to use my gavel or the pink slip. You can tell that Mimi is a reference librarian, detailed, precise, and absolutely on time, on the mark. Okay. Thank you. And with that, we'll turn to Tinsley Yarborough.
Thank you, Barbara. I enjoyed that presentation very much. This is going to be a hard act to follow. I finished my biography of Justice Blackmun in 2006, just as I was retiring from teaching. And since that time, unlike my young friend Henry Abraham, I've been happily beyond the court, pursuing a hobby interest in Western movie locations and that sort of thing, and playing Gramps to my grandchildren. In fact, Barbara mentioned that this panel is covering the court, the sequel. The last movie I attended, I believe, with my grandson Jonah was Alvin and the Chipmunks, the Squeakquel, and so that is about it. But I am happy to get briefly back into the court business for this morning, and I'm happy to be on this panel. Viewed superficially, Harry Blackmun's life and career read like the traditional American success story. Came from a relatively modest family background in St. Paul, Minnesota, but graduated from a fine St. Paul high school. The Minnesota Harvard Club gave him a scholarship to Harvard, so he attended Harvard as an undergraduate, and then attended Harvard Law School, received honors there. Next, he clerked for a judge of the Eighth Circuit, a very distinguished judge, John Sandberg. And then he went into practice in one of Minneapolis's most distinguished law firms, the Dorsey Firm, earned a good reputation in tax and estate law there. And in 1950, after doing a good bit of work for Mayo Clinic, became a general counsel to Mayo Clinic. He would later say those were the happiest 10 years of his life, the years there at Mayo Clinic dealing with what most of us, I think, would not find to be such an interesting career interest in tax and estate law, but he found it very interesting. His nomination to the Eighth Circuit in 1959 came as a result of sponsorship by Judge Sandburn and also by his boyhood friend, Warren Berger, who was then in the Eisenhower administration. He served on the Eighth Circuit with considerable distinction, and then in 1970, the year after his boyhood friend had become Nixon's Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, He won nomination to the Supreme Court of the United States. He would serve on the Supreme Court for 24 years. His most famous opinion, of course, would be the majority opinion in Roe v. Wade, one of the most praised and reviled cases in modern American history. The general theory would be that gradually on the court, actually rather quickly, he evolved from being a traditional conservative Republican of the Burger ilk into a liberal justice who would take liberal positions throughout his career. In his last term, in fact, he dissented when the Supreme Court denied review in a Texas death penalty case, and used that occasion to say that any hope of making the death penalty anything but an arbitrary punishment was doomed, and that he would no longer tinker with the machinery of death. So viewed superficially, this is the look we get of Justice Blackmun. But once I got into Blackmun's papers, especially the diary he kept for about 20 years, and his letters and other material, and once I interviewed a goodly number of his clerks, I realized that more was at work than the well-known Blackmun humility, that this was a man with some very serious insecurities. His father was a failed businessman going from one business interest to another. His mother, because of early tragedies in her life, was emotionally a very fragile woman. And Harry was a rather insecure young man. I say somewhere in the book that for Harry, every silver lining had a dark cloud. He simply had a difficulty there. And when he went on the court, he had difficulty completing opinions in his early assignments. In fact, Justice Black, who wrote his own opinions in longhand, got them over with, and that was it, complained to the members of the court that they were being held up in important work. Well, at that point, a clerk asked Justice Blackmun if he could try his hand at writing an opinion. I believe it was the alienage case, Graham versus Richardson. And Justice Blackmun said yes. And from that point on, Justice Blackmun assigned the opinion writing, most of it, to his clerks. And some critics, including the distinguished historian David Garrow, have used that to suggest that Justice Blackmun, because of his insecurities, simply abdicated his responsibilities as a justice, that his clerks were Blackmun's brains, the theory went. Now, I think that is overdrawn for several reasons. First of all, Justice Blackmun, beginning in the circuit court and then in the Supreme Court, had a habit of writing his own little memos about each case, suggesting the position he would take. These were not cert memos, bench memos, as clerks would do. They were his. He continued that on the Supreme Court. The clerks I interviewed knew nothing about those memos, but his secretary did, because often he would dictate them and then she would hurriedly type them. Those memos indicate that however his insecurity about constitutional doctrine and his willingness to let his bright clerks do the drafting of opinions while he edited mainly for grammar and other rather minor corrections, that this did not indicate that he simply didn't know what was going on. Also, his clerks pointed out to me that right after conference, he would go to his clerks and he would go through the conference that the justices had just held, sometimes with dead-on mimicking of his colleagues. and describing in detail the arguments that took place in the justices' conference on particular cases and the position that he would take. And so he was not abdicating his responsibility. For whatever reason, he simply did not have the confidence, I guess, to actually fully draft those opinions. But he did exert a tremendous influence on the court. And like many insecure people, he had a real streak of stubbornness. I think that accounts a good bit for the position he took on the abortion issue and the fierce defense that he made of the abortion opinions and other opinions with which he was connected. I don't want to suggest, though, that there was no humor in Justice Blackmun. I think his clerks loved him. His secretaries were devoted to him. He was a wonderful man, and he had quite a sense of humor. Once one of his clerks, who was a Baltimore Orioles fan and knew Justice Blackmun was a great baseball fan, took him to an Orioles game. And they were watching the game and kept noticing a little boy with a baseball that he wanted one of the players to sign. And this kid was trying to get the attention of the dugout and get the player to sign the ball. And finally, the clerk simply took the ball from the kid and said, "Here, let's let this gentleman sign it." And he gave it to Justice Blackmun to sign. The kid grabbed the ball and said, "This ball is for Cal Ripken." And Justice Blackmun got a great kick out of that. And when he was dying and a clerk came in to see him, he said, "Get me out of here." He was in the hospital and terrible pain. He said, "Get me out of here." And the clerk suggested a writ of habeas corpus. And he said, "Fine, you draft it and I'll sign it." Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Tinsley. You can see why Tinsley Yarborough was one of the most popular professors at East Carolina. Superb job.
My students might debate that.
I'll go toe-to-toe with them. And with that, we turn things over to Amy Campbell, Justice Ginsburg.
Hi. It is not very often that I have the opportunity in a forum like this to say thank you to two people who mean so much to me. And I'm reminded of the quote, maybe I'm from Amherst County, Virginia, and maybe this is something we say there and not anywhere else, so forgive me if it's a little hokey, but if you see a turtle sitting up on a fence post, you can be reasonably sure it had help getting there. And so I would like to say, you know, I'm the turtle up on the fence post, and Barbara Perry and Henry Abraham are absolutely how I got there, how I got here. And there have been so many opportunities in my life based on the fact that they had confidence in me. And I went on to do whatever set of work that was, whatever writing it was, whatever opportunity. And they awarded me with another. And not just me, but so many of their students. And I think I'll be turning 35 tomorrow, which is, seems incredibly old. And I think this must be the beginning of the time when you start to reflect back and think about your, you know, how did I get here? And what have I been doing all this time? So I wanted to say thank you very much. They are absolutely how this work came to be. When I left Sweetbriar, I came to the University of Virginia and had always been interested in constitutional law and was familiar with Justice Ginsburg. Justice Ginsburg became a member of the court the year that I graduated from high school, which was 93. And what I was wanting to research and write about was, with all due respect to Justice Blackmun, why Roe versus Wade was so complicated. Why was the right to privacy so complicated, in my view? That's the best way to say it. And I began to look at this, and I spent about 6 months figuring out different approaches to Roe. And I worked with David O'Brien, professor. I'm sure if you're interested in constitutional law, you're familiar with Professor David O'Brien's work. Trying to figure out if Ginsburg had, let's say, first of all, been on the court, or even O'Connor, if they had been on the court when Roe versus Wade was decided, what would have been different? And so I had a set of answers for that. And I learned about the ACLU Women's Rights Project, which was what Ginsburg founded, co-founded, and was head of from 1972 to 1980. And as I got more into it, I realized that Ginsburg had made a conscious choice not to work on reproductive freedom cases during those crucial years, 1972 to 1980. And so while I am still very interested in what would have happened had the right to privacy been founded in the 14th Amendment rather than the penumbra of several amendments, what I learned was that Ginsburg was far more complex than anyone realized, that she was, in essence, a figure in the feminist movement. Now, I see the looks on your face. You think, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, feminist movement, totally different things. I had, again, seemingly it was fated that while I was beginning my research on Ginsburg, Gloria Steinem came and spent the day at the university. And as a fellow at the University of Virginia Women's Center, I was her buddy for the day. And so, of course, lovely woman, she wanted to know what I was studying here at the university. I think I was in my second year of graduate school at this point. And Ginsburg had been on the court about 5 years at this time. I explained to her why I was interested in Ginsburg and why I was interested in the ACLU Women's Rights Project and why reproductive freedom had been separated out. She was the one who said to me, she is one of the unsung heroes of the feminist movement. There were those of us who were out, and she actually said, just so you know, no bras were actually burned. There were those of us who were out, not bra burning, but marching in the streets and speaking to politicians and appearing on television when we could and appearing before in front of state legislatures much more often than that. And consciousness raising around the country. I think you should figure out what she was doing behind the scenes. And so these factors came together. And I'm not sure exactly how it happened, but some way, Professor Abraham, Professor Perry, and Professor O'Brien, of course, we're familiar with Ginsburg, and I think she would consider them friends. They found out that she was going to release a small subset of her papers from the time that she was with the ACLU Women's Rights Project to the Library of Congress. They would only be made available to President Clinton's Office of Legal Counsel. They would not be made available until, of course, the rest of her papers were made available after she left the court. I took a shot. And I wrote to her and said, I am a master's student at the University of Virginia, and I have this question that I'm interested in answering. It's just for my master's thesis. I'm not writing a book. The reason that I phrased it so delicately was because at that same year, a book called Closed Chambers was published. And Closed Chambers took a very detailed look inside the court. And if I am correct, it was one of Justice Blackmun's clerks who wrote the book. It was unpopular with many on the court. If you've read it, you know why. And the justices, I think, recoiled a bit from having people look into their papers. So I phrased my letter very delicately, and she wrote me back a very simple note: come to the court and let's talk about it. And so I did. And I think that she saw in me something she later confirmed in some correspondence we had, but I felt at the time that she saw in me just a curiosity. And as much as she was hesitant to defy what the other justices had done with respect to releasing their papers, she wanted to reward that curiosity. Always a professor, I think. And so I became the second person allowed to see her papers. And so for 2 years I spent, if you're familiar with the Library of Congress, the Jefferson Building is a gorgeous building and is, you know, probably one of the top sites in Washington, D.C. The sixth sub-basement of the Madison Building is really not much to see, but that is where her papers were kept. And I spent 2 years going through her papers and keeping my professor's advice and Gloria Steinem's advice in the back of my head. I had to dig really hard to figure out what her motivations were. And what I discovered was that she made these changes, sweeping changes, in the way gender-based discrimination is viewed. But just like you all thought when I said Ruth Bader Ginsburg is one of the unsung heroes of the feminist movement, she never wanted to be. And I think that's the bottom line, is that she believed in the core mission of a group of people working together all across the country to make small, incremental changes. She worked on 34 cases from the years 1972 to 1980. What she achieved in those 8 years is almost untouched today, with the exception of course, the Via My Opinion, which she wrote, which I think is certainly not an ending, but a beautiful part of the story. What I learned about Ginsburg is that the reason that she made these incremental changes in the law are that she believed sweeping victories are actually short-lived, and she didn't want to be responsible for a Brown versus Board, a Roe versus Wade. She wanted her legacy to be tiny pieces that live on and that are the seed for other cases. I believe that that is why the work that she did in the 70s sticks with us today, and why we're not arguing about, you know, for example, or versus or. Have you ever heard of that case? It's a pretty well-settled piece of law. We're not arguing about cases like that the way we are Roe versus Wade. And I think it is something that we should be tremendously grateful for. What I don't have time to talk about are the hilarious stories that she told me, and some of which I write about in the book. What I can tell you is that over the past 6 months, there have been two C-SPAN interviews, one from St. Louis, where she tells some of these stories. And so I encourage you to please get to know her in that way. You're obviously, you came here because you're interested in her as a justice, but I promise you, it is worth getting to know her as a woman. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. I think you're right that Hilarious and Ruth Bader Ginsburg probably also don't seem to go together, but she is a lovely woman, and I've gotten to know her a little bit over the years, and she has been just a truly wonderful person. So with that, we want to turn things over to you in the audience. Lee, who is in the back of the room, one of our wonderful volunteers here today, has a microphone. If you will hold your question until he gets to you, that way everyone in the chamber can hear you, as well as it will be on this streaming video, which the Thomas Jefferson Center has arranged. And this panel will also be on the Thomas Jefferson Center's website. So if you will raise your hand, Lee will come to you, and you may ask your question. Don't be shy. Here we have one, Lee.
I would love to hear one of your hilarious stories.
Oh, okay, sure. Gosh, let me think. Well, one thing I didn't mention that I brought, because I would love for people to come up and look at it, so it's a two-part answer. When I finished you'd call it now a manuscript, but then it was just my master's thesis. When I finished my master's thesis, she asked if she could read it, and or I offered, and you know, she accepted, and I sent it to her, and you know, I, as she was accustomed to doing every, you know, occasion, write me a little note like, enjoyed this, that, the other. Imagine my surprise when I received not this, but these pages bound by the court binding operation back. I had sent it to her as a PDF file, and she had it bound. She went through and made notes on almost every page. Some of them are hilarious anecdotes. Some of them are places where I made a leap in judgment, and she said, actually, no, you're giving me too much credit for that, or no, we were thinking of a different case when we prepared for that. But one of the stories that was not in my original master's thesis, but that she thought fit very well, was when she was at Harvard in law school. And she was one of only two women in the program, and there were these gatherings at the dean's house. Of course, she was wearing a skirt. And, of course, everyone was smoking. She was not that accustomed to smoking, but she felt that she should do it. When the ashtray was passed around, it somehow ended up with her. And so, sitting, she had it on her knee. Someone said something to her and distracted her, and she actually started, and the ashtray fell and spilled all over everyone. Okay? And part of the story that I don't talk about, that I didn't choose to publish, was that I think when she, if I'm remembering correctly, when she got up, part of her skirt had gotten tucked in the chair.
Oh, dear.
And so for several reasons, she later decided to leave Harvard and go to law school elsewhere. But according to her, she never outlived the shame of that incident. And so it was so funny to me, because she is nothing if not graceful and poised. And to think of her as a young woman in her 20s, horribly embarrassed, skirt half off, covered in ashes, at the dean's house of Harvard Law School. Thank you.
Just to follow up quickly on that anecdote, I heard recently Justice Ginsburg mention that, you know, she did leave Harvard after 2 years because her husband, Marty, who was a year ahead of her at Harvard, had taken a job in New York, and they already had a daughter by that time, and she didn't want to split up the family, so she finished out at Columbia. And she said that in the last few years, the then dean, Elena Kagan, who's now the first woman Solicitor General of the United States, had said to Justice Ginsburg, "Oh, we would love to honor you with an honorary law degree from Harvard." And she said, "No, thank you. I've done just well enough, thanks, with my Columbia law degree."
I did not know that. That's fantastic.
Yes, sir. Lee will come to you one moment.
Very curious about how Supreme Court justices are selected in the United States. And I was thinking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and how an ACLU lawyer, and I speak from experience here, how does an ACLU lawyer, particularly the head of the litigation outfit, Women's Rights, become a Supreme Court justice or a pick for a Supreme Court justice in the United States today?
Well, I would be happy to address Ruth Bader Ginsburg specifically, but I have deference to those who know it better than I do.
Can we turn to our other two panelists, first of all, and talk to Mimi about her dad and his selection you talked a little bit about, but certainly you've been so closely tied to the court and Washington. Mm-hmm. Would you like to mention a little bit about that?
Well, my father's appointment was very controversial. Of course, he was quite close to Truman. He had been loyal to Truman, and that was a trait that was very meaningful, very important to Harry Truman. But the appointment was controversial in a lot of the spectrum politically. The people who, as I had mentioned, thought that they were soft on communism, the individual liberties concerned because of some of the policies. And another thing that was surprising to people, at that time, there was an unwritten, an unstated Catholic seat. There was also the same situation with a Jewish seat. Well, Frank Murphy was a Catholic. My father followed Frank Murphy. Everyone anticipated that Harry Truman would appoint a Catholic to that position. So in that respect, the appointment was a surprise. There were also charges of cronyism. They said, Tom Clark was just a crony, a buddy of President Truman. But I think it also shows how things have changed. Now, Truman's appointment after my father was made to someone who was a Catholic. Today, there are 6 Catholics on the Supreme Court, 2 Jews, and 1 Protestant. So times have changed.
And just to come back to that question directly about Justice Ginsburg, in addition to being head of the Women's Rights Project for the ACLU, she was also a well-known scholar and professor. And she was appointed to the D.C. Circuit by Jimmy Carter, who never got a chance to appoint a member of the U.S. Supreme Court. But you might remember that he had, for want of a different term, an affirmative action program to try to appoint women and minorities to the lower federal benches. And so he did so in relatively speaking, great numbers. And that was then her proving ground to get to the U.S. Supreme Court. Of course, she was appointed by Bill Clinton. And she told us this story about the same time I think she told about turning down her honorary degree from Harvard. She said that she'd been out on a speaking tour when she was a professor, and it took her to University of Arkansas at Little Rock. And she called Marty, her husband, that night and said, I'm so excited. I gave my talk. And the Governor Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary came to my talk. And Marty said, well, what else would there have been to do in Little Rock in the evening? So don't get too big ahead. But keep those contacts, networking. It was Bill Clinton as president who appointed her to the Supreme Court.
And I would just add specifically with Ginsburg, she had been on the short list before, and it was being on the Court of Appeals that I think was where she attracted the attention of sort of that the inner circle of that Washington elite that eventually helped President Clinton make the decision. So her work at the ACLU was certainly the background, but it was the cases that she worked on at the Court of Appeals and served with Justice Scalia before he was appointed to the court that attracted the attention of the decision makers.
Other questions? Yes, sir.
Hi, I was, excuse me. I was curious about how the Supreme Court dealt with choosing their cases when they felt that a case was coming to them where they could only decide using the Constitution, and they really knew that any decision they made was not going to be a good decision because they were limited. And were they able to avoid cases, or did they deliberately avoid hearing cases where they felt like there was a lose-lose situation because of the limitations of what they could do, and that their decision would not really be a good decision either way?
Right. So this question is about how the court makes decisions, particularly if they feel limited in certain ways or if they feel limited by the Constitution, which gets to Mimi's point about her father and how he viewed the Constitution. But could I turn that to Tinsley, since you've spent so much time in the papers of justices, and particularly Justice Blackmun, who did take such detailed notes. Did you ever find in conference that he would take notes about the strategy of how they decided when to take particular cases?
I didn't in his notes. They essentially dealt with the substantive issues. But I think to get to the point of your question, the justices often do delay bringing an issue up, a case up, or type of case until they're ready, and that means, among other things, that until they're not so internally divided over how to deal with the particular case. But essentially, there's all the justices have a chance to put their 2 cents worth in. There's a vote of four on whether, if that's needed, whether a case will be accepted or not. But a lot of cases get overlooked, I'm sure. Other cases are deemed important enough by everyone and pressing enough so that they go ahead and decide it at the time. And there is a certain list that most of the justices participate in that sort of turns over to an individual clerk to prepare a certain memo for a particular case. There are two justices, though, and you always need some justices who don't take part in the cert pool of justices, so they have an independent view. I think Scalia and Stevens.
Justice Stevens is not in the cert pool and has never been
right.
Since he's been there,
right.
Since 1975. And Justice Alito,
Decided
not to participate
right.
in the so-called cert pool or pooled memos from
right.
the clerks. I don't think I'm telling tales out of school to relate this anecdote. Bob O'Neill tells it all the time. He was a clerk to Justice Brennan. And as Tinsley mentioned, in order to get a case taken on appeal at the court, you need to convince four members of the court, not five, interestingly enough. Obviously, you need five, though, to make the judgment. And so Bob tells the story of Justice Brennan going off to conference to decide which cases to take that week. And only the justices go to conference. No clerks, no secretaries are there. And as it turned out, Justice Brennan was going to vote to take a particular case. I thought he could certainly get the four votes. He was going to be one of them. He got into the conference, and he did his head count, and he did have four justices to vote to take the case, but he decided not to vote to take the case because he couldn't find his fifth vote. to decide the cases he wanted to decide it. And I believe it was Justice Goldberg who afterwards, after the conference, said, but Bill, I thought you were going to vote to take this case on appeal. And Justice Brennan said, where's your fifth vote, Arthur, or Art? And so that was one of Justice Brennan's favorite tricks to play on his new clerks. He'd say, what's the most important word at this court? And they would say, justice, equality, law, and he'd stop and they'd say, we give up, what is it? And he'd hold up his hand. He'd say, five. If you have five, you can do anything at this court.
Well, I think Brown v. Board could be used maybe a little bit different from your question, but similar. It came on the docket, I believe, in 52, and I think it was Frankfurter asked for a delay. And at that time, Chief Justice Vinson was Chief Justice, and it was pretty clear there was not a unanimous court. There were a couple of people who, if the vote had been taken at that time, I think would have dissented in that opinion. Well, in 1953, September, I think, Chief Justice Vinson died. Brown v. Board once more was under consideration. Earl Warren was Chief Justice, and he was able to persuade a unanimous court, or to have a unanimous court on that decision. So again, they weren't ready in the 52. The justices just weren't ready to hand it down.
Well, I understand that there is not another panel, as I say, coming in after us. So those of you who wish to say are welcome to do so. Those who are going on to other festival events, please feel free. But we have a few more questions. Rob, yes? Wait for the microphone, please.
Yes, thank you. Barbara, I was wondering if you might just say a few words handicapping what you think might be on Justice Stevens' mind.
Oh, yeah, that was a big news story, wasn't it, this week? And it has been since the court came back into session for this term. It is common wisdom that Justice Stevens might be leaving at the end of this term, retiring. As you know, there's no retirement age. He will turn 90 on April the 20th. And he has only hired one clerk instead of his full complement of four for next term. I, on the other hand, think that if his health holds out, and we seem to indicate that it is holding out, that he might try to stay to get the Oliver Wendell Holmes record, which is just a few months beyond age 90, and that if he gets to that record, he might go for the second record, which is longevity of service, which is 36 and a half years on the part of William O. Douglas. So if he can stay about another year and a half, he'll have that record as well. But we won't be surprised if he should decide to step down at the end of this term. I for one, I'm hoping he goes for both records, being the athletic person that I am. Yes, sir.
Didn't mean to make him run all the way up.
That's okay. That's his exercise for today.
Philosophically speaking, we often hear about judges that are appointed that are considered to be conservative, and they become less conservative. We hear of judges that are conservative and they remain conservative, or judges that are liberal and they remain liberal. Are there many instances of judges who are appointed and considered liberal who in fact become conservatives in the eyes of opinion writers? And if that's not the case, is it the isolation of the court that, in your opinion, makes judges swing to the left?
Well, I don't know that this is a good example, but when Justice White was appointed, I have a feeling President Kennedy thought he would be a good liberal because he had been in the Justice Department. He had been a strong supporter of enforcement of civil rights and that sort of thing. And at least for the period he served on the court, he was a pretty conservative justice, particularly in criminal procedure issues. Professor Abraham, do you have another example that you would cite?
This would be of a person who was put on the court thinking that person was liberal
and then became conservative.
And then became conservative.
that he was a person was liberal and became conservative.
Right. I'm thinking of Justice Frankfurter. Would you put him in that category?
Well,
that
people misunderstood Justice Frankfurter. Frankfurter was a devoted and a devout liberal. He took on a very, very difficult and case which featured a major injustice in the annals of our country, the Sacco Vanzetti case, which many of you remember. He was always a liberal professor at Harvard. He took on that case and defended it beautifully, but he did not succeed. On the bench, however, this very liberal person, left-wing liberal person, became devoted to the concept of abstemiousness. He believed very strongly that when in doubt, say no. That went not only in terms of what kind of cases to accept, but not to interfere too much in prior decisions. He was very principled. He was a wonderful example of judicial restraint. He was always consistent on that issue. And he loved the court, he loved his country, but he was certainly a wonderful example of someone who was a born liberal, remained a liberal, was a liberal individual, but in terms of his jurisprudence and his attachment to the bench, to the court, he became, if you want to, a conservative. Justice Black, I'm digressing just a little bit, was someone who, of course, as you know, had a Ku Klux Klan past. But he became a leading liberal in the Congress and ultimately became the leading liberal on the bench. As he grew older, he was on the bench for 34 years. His jurisprudence was quite consistent, but some people who regarded him as being unfaithful to the liberal cause claimed that was because he was senile. He was not senile, he was simply consistent. That was particularly true. So those are some examples. Of course, there's the opposite, wonderful example of the opposite, namely a soi-disant conservative becoming an outstanding liberal. That was that strange man, ex-Justice David Hackett Souter, about whom
Tinsley's
Tinsley
book
Arbor
will
also
tell wrote. You about that.
He has an incredible number of books to his credit, and he is our leading judicial biographer. Well, Souter, of course, was a very interesting guy, but he was a very strange person. One could say a lot about him. He had no record when he attained the court, really. No one really knew. He had 1 year, not even quite 1 year, on the circuit bench. He was Attorney General for a very brief period, but he was his own person. But he was reclusive, and he was intriguing in a good many ways. For example, he told me that when I came to Washington, I thought I could just rent a room and live there, and Justice O'Connor told me that wouldn't do. So that he didn't like light. And when I once saw him in his chambers, he said, "Would you like some light, Professor Abraham?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he turned on the table lamp in the corner. So. But he was a brilliant individual intellectually. He was beautifully trained. He was a Rhodes Scholar. And he was Harvard, and we have to genuflect, as you know. But
So Henry, I think that's the perfect note to end on, that Justice Souter became a liberal when he saw the light. At the Supreme Court. Well, thank you all so much for being here today. You are a wonderful, lively audience, and we thank you so much for your questions and comments. Please come forward if you wish to look at our books today, and again, we'd be happy to inscribe them for you. Thanks again.
Enjoyed your presentation very much.